Cool. So my name is Elena, and thanks so much for coming to my talk. I know it's very special for me to be here giving a talk because I came here 3 years ago as a student, and I remember at the time I was struggling a bit with my PhD thesis because I was on my second year and things were not working. So Eric told me, recommended me to come here, and I met great people. I worked with Cassandra, Matt Benton, and Ari Wormflatch, who is now my boss. And so, and also it gave me a lot of motivation to continue with my PhD, which is what I'm gonna talk about today. And my talk is gonna mix actually what I was struggling with then and what I'm working on now with Arya. So first I want to thank my PhD supervisor David, who is there, Eric and Francis, who gave me a lot of advice on my PhD as well, and my lab right now, well, yeah, Wormflash lab, who are very patient with me, struggling to do experiments, coming from a mathematical background, and of course KITP for giving me the opportunity of talking today here. So at the time I was working on a mathematical model of vulval development, trying to improve what Eric and Francis had published, and I attached the paper in the email. And so you know, probably know better than me about C. elegans, but it's a tiny worm who is good because it's transparent, so you can see what's going on inside. And so we were trying to understand how vulva develops. And in this system, there are five cells, which are called vulval precursor cells, which will become three different types of cells, so inner vulva, outer vulva, or non-vulva, which I will represent by the red, green, and blue colors. And I will call phase one, phase two, phase three to be quicker. And so the way they pattern depends on an outer cell called anchor cell, which sends EGF signal to them. And so they also depend on a secondary signal that send, so it's a paracrine signal called Notch that they send to the neighbors. And so the cell that receives the most amount of EGF signal becomes first phase and starts sending Notch signaling to the neighbors. And so these neighbors become second phase, and the cells that don't receive much of any of those signals become third phase. And as you see, the system is quite symmetrical, so you can just focus on studying three cells. So the data set that we count on was a set of experiments in which the biologists changed the amount of signals that the cells were receiving, or the receptors in the cells. So there is a set of experiments in which they get wild-type pattern, even though they remove the receptors on the middle cell or have the EGF or Notch signaling. There are another set of experiments in which they remove Notch and they play with EGF, and you can get so if you remove Notch and you put twice as much EGF, this one will receive enough EGF to become first phase, and you will get the 1-1-3 pattern. And so, but if you maintain wild type, this one won't receive Notch nor enough EGF, and they will become third phase, and you will get the 1-3-3 pattern. And then there are other experiments in which you can get a mix of outcomes, and those are EGF overexpression or playing with how long EGF signal is present in the system.
That's probably a detail, but do you know how they overexpress EGF in this context? Is it conditional?
So that's a parameter that I fit in my model, because I don't have a quantity of how much. You know that it's more than wild type, but you don't know. So I use that as a parameter.
Yeah, I was asking experimentally, so maybe it's off.
Oh, if I know, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
I guess it would be a duplication, but I am not positive.
Yeah, it's kind of 2 and something. I think I get the 2.5 or something like that. Oh. Twice as, a bit more than twice as much, yeah. Yeah, so the common approach is to look at the gene regulatory network that contains all the molecules involved in the system. And then, well, yeah, as James explained this morning, you write a differential equation for each of them. And then you see what are the equilibria of that system. But as you can see here, normally that turns into a lot of equation, a lot of parameters, and this mechanistic drawing shows you a lot of how the particles interact, but it doesn't tell you much about the dynamics or what's happening, how this system evolves. Especially, what are the stable states or what are the saddles where cells don't know where to go. The question is, can we find a simpler model that reflects how the cells decide what type of cell they are going to become by just taking some essential qualities of the system, which in our case are that we have 3 stem cells that receive 2 signals, and they can become 3 types of cells, and that the first signal promotes first fate, and the second signal promotes second fate.
So the first wiring diagram you showed was derived from experimental results.
Yes.
And now you're ignoring that for the moment and trying to come up with a simpler explanation.
Yeah.
So overall, so what's this going towards? I mean, what's the goal with the simpler system?
If
you can explain these patterns with a simpler system, what will then that
So, well, you will have a simpler model with which you would be able to predict things in a easier way.
But if the original complicated wire diagram was based on experimental results, what's the relevance of a more simple model?
Yeah, so imagine that you don't have that. You don't have that. Experimental result. You
okay.
don't know.
So
yeah.
Just so explore different possible models as to how it could hypothetically.
So I'm testing this idea in a model that has already been done, and in a simple system to kind of compare the two. But yes, for example, I'm working with James or in an area where. In a system where we don't know exactly the gene regulatory network behind. So we are trying to develop, with these ideas, like a model that would allow us to predict, for example, a good protocol to obtain a certain type of cell, depending on the signals that you put in the system. But you don't need to, yeah, sorry.
Your assumption's wrong. I mean,
okay.
It's not based on.
That's
it's
what
based
I was,
on some experimental results.
I was asking,
a lot of
yes.
guesswork.
That's what I was wondering, basically. How much. Yeah.
But
now
sorry,
that
I didn't
makes
understand
more sense.
That.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think it's worth coming back to discuss this at the end when you've shown
what
the logical model will do.
Yeah. So yeah, so I'm not using any of the previous experimental knowledge.
Sure.
Just the data, the outcomes of your experiment. Yeah. Okay, so the idea is based on Waddington's landscape, in which a ball, which represents a cell, is going down a hill and going, taking some decisions in that path downhill and ending up in an attractor that will represent the type of cell. And this landscape where the cell is moving, it's shaped by the signals that the cell receives, or the genes that are on and off. Okay, so an intuitive picture is just imagine a ball on a surface, on a flat surface, and now you shaped it so that there is an attractor there. So of course the ball would move toward that attractor. So if this attractor represents a fate or a type of cell, and the ball represents a cell, a stem cell, the fact that the ball moves to the attractor means that the stem cell became that type of cell. Of course, in the systems, we have more than one type of cell. So you can have two attractors. And the deeper one would attract the ball more, and that ball will move toward that attractor. And so these depths will be controlled by the signals, and the ball will be attracted to the corresponding type of cell. As you saw, the ball is moving with a velocity that is the gradient of the landscape. So if your ball is in one of the attractors, here the gradient of the landscape is zero, so the ball gets stuck there. If you have a negative gradient, your ball is moving with minus the gradient, so it's positive and it's moving on an x coordinate. Sorry, this is positive gradient, so minus positive is negative, so it's moving backwards, so it's moving that direction. And here the gradient is negative, so minus the gradient is positive, so the ball moves towards here. Okay, so let's put an example. Imagine that you have a surface that is just flat and it's equal to x. So if you put a ball there and you say that its velocity is minus the gradient of that surface, that's minus 1. And if you solve this dynamical system, which is velocity equal minus 1, the position of the ball will be minus t plus where it started. So if the ball starts here, with time it will move in this direction. Is it clear? Yeah, okay. Now, we want our landscape to be varying on the signal, so we need to add parameters so that the surface is changing with the signals. So in this case it's B, and if we have this potential function, it has this shape with two minima, which are attractors, and a maxima that is a saddle point where the ball, if it is here, it doesn't know where to go. So if we change the parameters, yeah, as I say, it has an attractor and a saddle, two attractors and a saddle. So if we change B, we can change the shape of the landscape. And we see that this minima and this saddle are moving together. And once they collide, that's called a bifurcation, because one attractor is disappearing. And so B is making a bifurcation to happen, and in a way that we only obtain one attractor, and the ball would move to this point. Yeah.
Should it be BX instead of B? Because if it's just B, it's the translation of the long y-axis, right?
Oh, yes, it's BX. Yeah, thank you. Sorry. I miss here and next. Okay, so everyone follows so far. Okay, so now let's put this into mathematical terms. So we saw that V was depending on X and a parameter. So we have a family of functions where S is called the state space and C is the control space or parameter space. And so for each value of the parameter, we will have a function or a fixed landscape, right? And changing on the on changing C, we are changing the landscape. If we take the gradient or the derivative of the landscape, if it's equal to zero, we are in a point in which the ball is not moving, so it's called critical point. And if the second derivative is also zero, then it's called degenerate. And it's when the two critical points collide, and it's basically an inflection point. So knowing those terms, one can define what is called catastrophe manifold, which is the set of all the parameters with their corresponding critical points in the manifold. So if you consider all the possible landscape that a function with its parameters can define, then the set of all the critical points of that is called catastrophe manifold. And if you consider just the degenerate points, which is where the bifurcations happen, it's called singularity set. And if you only consider the parameters, they tell you, so this set tells you which parameters have bifurcations. So when bifurcation points are going to happen. So that's interesting because you know then when your system is going to have an attractor disappearing. So a fate is going to disappear. And the cool thing is that we have a theorem that says that any family of functions locally is one of these. So all the bifurcations that you can see in a dynamical system, if it's not oscillator, it's containing one of these polynomial landscapes. And the cool thing also is that they are of one or two variables. So it doesn't matter if you have, for example, a dynamical system that is comprised of thousand genes that locally is going to be like one of these catastrophes. So the idea is to use them as building blocks to build a more complex landscape. So the thing is, Eric and Francis built a landscape from a symmetrical equation. And so if you want to modify that for another type of system, that's very complicated because you don't know. You can use actually these equations to tailor your landscape to the problem that you have. Okay, so I'm going to go through the fault and the cusp because I'm going to use them as building blocks to make the landscape that we think represents how the vulval development is. Okay, so the fault has this form, and if you substitute C with different values, you get one minima and one maxima. And if you change the parameter, you can make the minima to disappear until it's no longer there. Okay, so how can I explain that? So I'm going to compute this catastrophe manifold and the singularity test. So the catastrophe manifold are the points in which the parameters and its values where the landscape has critical points. So a critical point is when the landscape gradient is zero. So are the points such that x is equal to minus c. So for each value of c, I will have zero attractors, I will have one attractor, or I will have two attractors. Is that clear? Yes.
What would be the case for more than one dimensional? Because, you know, if you're talking about genes, there are maybe thousands of dimensions, mm-hmm. right? So what if I have three dimensions? So the other two dimensions will be slack, or?
So the dynamics will send you to what those other two important ones are. And so, right, David?
So if I have x, y, then they will send me to a line, maybe? I'm not sure.
So
if you have three x state variables, you'll just get an extra quadratic term on the end. So it's just goes away.
Okay.
Well, if you compute the secondary derivative that tells you the degenerate points. It tells you that the bifurcation happens at c equals zero. So for any value of c negative, you will have a maxima and a minima as we saw. So I put it here. So if you have c less than zero, you have a maxima and a minima. If you move c to zero, you will have this inflection point, so the bifurcation happens.
What's the news on...
And if C is positive, that you don't have any equilibria there. So we know, with this polynomial, we know exactly in the parameter space how your attractors change.
So they measured this and there was some weirdness.
Okay, so the cast is a bit more complicated. You have two parameters and one... a variable, so your catastrophe manifold is going to be in 3D. So for each value of the parameters, if you intersect with the manifold, you know how many attractors your function has. So let's make an example. So this is the bifurcation set. That is the values of the parameters A and B at which you have a bifurcation happening. So if you are outside this cast, like here, you have one equilibria, which is this one. So here I'm plotting the landscape. So this equilibria is this point. It's like basically a map of what's happening in the landscape. If I move inside the cast, I will have three equilibria, like there. If I am at the border, I know that a bifurcation is happening. So this that was a minima with this that was a maxima have collided into a point. And I no longer have that minima, and I have left this minima there. And if I move to this side, I have one equilibria, which is the maxima there. Okay, so I know exactly which parameters give me how many equilibria in my system. Is that clear? So that's the important thing, that you know exactly how the landscape looks like with respect to the parameters. Because then you know, for example, if A was a signal and B was another signal, you know how to change B to get the fate that you want or the attractor that you want. So we want to build this type of landscape, which is a two-dimensional landscape in the equation. In which we think that, so blue is third phase, green is second phase, and red is first phase. So we think that third phase is a default state, because if you don't see any signal, you remain in three. Then you have a saddle here that represents whether you are going to differentiate or not. And you can either differentiate to first phase or to second phase. And so you have another saddle here that represents whether you are going to differentiate into second or to first phase. So we need a landscape with three attractors and two saddles like that. So I'm gonna explain this. How do I obtain? I don't know if the people over there see this plan for. Okay. So in this case, I'm no longer in the same space of one dimension, but I am in two dimensions, because it's like looking at a landscape of valleys and mountains from above. So this would be a mountain, this would be a valley, another mountain, another valley. And I want to make it. Okay. So I have that dy dt is equal to this. So y is moving as this is telling me. So if I make dy dt equal to zero, it tells me when my ball is not moving on the y direction. So it's dy dt equals zero. Even only if this is zero or this is zero. So if y is equal to zero, or if y is equal to m plus minus square root of minus c. Yes. Okay, so well, if y is zero, or y is m minus square root of minus c, or y is m plus square root of minus c. And then dx dt is equal to zero. So if y is equal to 0, chi of y is equal to 1. So this is dy dt, dx dt is equal to f of x a b, which is the cusp. So I will have, as I explained, 3, 2, or 1 values of x. So if y is equal to 0, I'm in this lane. So here I would have 3. I can also bifurcate away these 2, or these can collide together to make 2 attractors, as I saw in the cusp. Or I can bifurcate this one with this one. So in this line, I would have 3, 2, or 1 attractors. And if y is equal to this, which is bigger than 0, chi of y is 0. So I'm in here. So if and only if x is 0, So x is 0 here, so it will be this point, x0 m minus square root of minus c, or this point, which is m plus square root of minus c. And they can, so if you consider so this part basically is the equation of a fold. So these two can bifurcate together. Okay, so I'm going to explain. So basically, depending on C, I would have these two here. If I'm in a C less, I mean, negative, I would have these two points. If I move to a C equals 0, they would bifurcate. And if I move to a C bigger than 0, they will no longer be there. Okay. Any questions? Here. So I can do the same as I. This is quite complicated to explain, but what I can now get is a bifurcation set, which tells me at which points of my space ABC I get points colliding. So I know that bifurcations are happening. So for any value of, so for value of C equals 0, we saw that there is a fold happening for any values of A and B. So I will have this plane that would correspond to the two points. So this bifurcation is controlled by C. And when C is equal to 0, they collide together. And for any value of C, as we saw here, we will have the cusp. So this is a cusp for any value of C. And so these bifurcations are controlled by the parameters A and B. So if I am inside the cusp, as we saw before, there will be the three equilibria here. And if I go out of the cusp, I will get one of them, either this one or this one. So okay. So if I'm behind C, in a C negative, and inside the cusp, I would have all the attractors. If I move, if I'm still on C negative, but I move to the boundary of the cusp, we saw that we had a bifurcation point. If we move out of the cusp, that bifurcation point disappears, and I have this attractor. If now I cross this plane, I'm bifurcating these two. If I go again to the boundary of the cusp, I'm getting the bifurcation back. And if I'm inside the cusp, I get the three back again. So what I'm showing here is that for any value of the parameters, I know exactly how the landscape looks like. So. So now we go back to the biology. So in biology, in the biological process, we had two signals, AGF and NOTCH, which should be the real parameters of the system. So then I have to write A, B, and C as functions of EGF and NOTCH, because the real parameters are EGF and NOTCH. So I'm having a two-dimensional space inside this three-dimensional space, so that also for each value of the EGF, I would be in a point in this 3D space, and I will be able to reconstruct my landscape. Is that clear now? I see weird faces.
That's not your fault.
So, I need to go back to my biological parameters. So I need to explain A, B, and C as the real parameters. So EGF and Notch define a 2D plane that I embed inside here. And so the parameters A, B, and C, which are these ones, sorry, are a function of EGF and Notch. Well, so long story short, then I can write the equations with that dynamical system. And so if you remember that this attractor represents first fate, and this is second fate, and this is third fate, and the red ball represents P6P, the green ball represents P5P, and this ball represents P4P. If I want the wild type pattern, that means this ball needs to remain in this attractor, this ball needs to go to this attractor, and this ball needs to go to this one. So if I run the system with parameters that I fitted, you see that the ball quickly goes to first fate, this one goes to second fate, and that one remains there. So I have a competence time in which I have signals, and then I go back to post-competence where I don't have signals. So I go back to this landscape, and basically they are where they should be.
Are you going to say something about how you fit the parameters?
Yes. Okay, so then I have a bunch of experiments, and I have parameters representing the signals. And also, actually, I didn't talk about it, but I also have to represent the interactions between the cells. So I am simulating three cells, and I put, it's inspired by Eric and Francis. If a cell is moving toward the first attractor, start sending Notch to the neighboring cell. So then the Notch signal of the neighboring cells is going up. So now I have this bunch of experiments, and I want to find the parameters that do this in my simulation. So from my simulations, I can get 9 numbers that tell me what is the proportion of that each cell, each of the three cells went to each of the three attractors. So I have 9 numbers, and I have the 9 numbers from the data. So I define a basic distance between my simulation and the data, and I am trying to minimize that distance, which will mean that my simulations reproduce the data. So I use ABC, as James mentioned before. And this ABC algorithm starts with a large distance. So you accept, you randomly pick parameters and you simulate. And then you see what's the distance between your simulation and the data. And you start with a large simulation, with a large distance. So you accept a lot of particles at the beginning. And once you have a bunch of particles that more or less reproduce your data, you sequentially decrease that distance. so that you approximate better and better your data. So, for example, these two parameters that I was feeding, the orange cloud is the cloud with which I started, and they were distance 4, you cannot see there, sorry, distance 4 from the data. And then I sequentially repeat and change a bit the parameters, converging to a better and better cloud of parameters, which are the purple ones, which reproduce the data with distance 0.8. And I actually used 9 sets of experiments to feed my data. And for example, here are some results. So the darker ones are the real data, and the white ones are my simulations. And you can see that it's basically the same. So you have the wild type pattern here, 1, 2, 3. If you put no notch and wild type EGF, you should have the 1, 3, 3. And EGF over expression reproduces that you have more second phase than first phase, but you have some first phase in P5P. And not only that, I can also predict at least 6 experiments. I didn't try more, but I can predict some of the anchor cell ablation experiments and some plays with the EGF and notch.
So you didn't use these experiments for the fitting?
No.
Sufficient those 3 experiments, those 3?
Oh, I actually used 9.
I see.
Of the sets, I just put 3 because it was going to be overwhelming. But then I predicted 6 so far.
6 additional ones that had been done.
Yes, and that, yeah.
You sort of retro-dicted them, right?
Uh-huh.
So was it, how carefully did you have to pick which experiments to use for the fitting?
Yes, that's a good question. So I did it sequentially. I tried to fit at least a small number of experiments and try to predict. And when I saw that I didn't have good predictions, I added another one more. But I picked all of the wild type patterns and this with no notch wild type EGF and twice as much EGF. And I got also 3 in which I had a mix of fates, so EGF overexpression, and I also used an anchor cell ablation that gave me the 3 fates in one cell, which means that at some point you have to be very close to a saddle, so that constrained my, So I went from, Eric also. We went from 60 equations with 40 parameters to 6 equations. Yeah.
Are the parameters biologically plausible?
Good question. So some of them, yes. For example, how much? Well, that's a question. If you could measure the EGF signal in a cell, that would be, that's what I'm trying to do in the next. So if you can see actually how much signal you have in time, that would be a good, but yeah, good to check. Or, the autocrine signal as well, how much notch signaling you are accepting. Those kind of parameters. I don't know if they can be done in a worm. I don't know the experimental limitations of that.
Well, it's not necessarily how well you can go on and measure to check whether they fit, but in general, generally biological plausible in terms of the biochemistry and interaction. This is a question.
The parameters are plausible in the sense that in some cases we fit, you know, VGF and Notch hypermorphs to reasonable numbers, some of which are checked. It's very hard to get. So, I mean, you know, so people have, can have one or two copies, of the, you know, one or four copies of the gene or something, so you get some rough numbers that way. But otherwise, I mean, there are no decent fluorescent recorders that work. The more revealing experiments, which have yet to be done, are things where particular time courses elicit unusual outcomes. And those are much more, I think, discriminatory models because it's some non-trivial dynamic protocol which biologists would never think of, which we would claim has some interesting phenotype. And you want to set up the experiment such that you don't care about levels, just care about times. And times you can control very well by the fluidics. So those are sort of experiments we're privileging.
So,
but isn't sort of the question more about how can you map your model parameters back to biological measurable parameters?
Yeah, so for example, the EGF overexpression, but some of them, I think it would be quite big.
You don't know any biological numbers for this system. And of course, there would be in biological units, not efficacy units. So I mean, you do have things like half copy, you know, half of wild type or two times wild type. And then there were some experiments with Felix where she tried to use RNAi to somewhat partially knock down things. And then, you know, it's a stronger OB phenotype. But most of the cases, we have to fit the number. We have to fit the model number that gives the observed phenotype. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, we could do crosses, which are a way of checking the model. But these dynamic experiments, I think, are the most, potentially the most revealing.
Yeah, so those were, yeah.
Let me expose my ignorance. So here, basically, you have three fates and then two parameters that, you know, we didn't have to explain.
Uh-huh.
How much can you blow this out of proportion and say that instead of giving you these two parameters, I give you an RNA-seq data set and ask you, can you find me how many different cell types there are by finding how many interactors there are, and that's even possible.
But that's a different, that wouldn't be modeling, right? That would be more of data analysis. So you have the data, yeah.
Yes, but my point there would be, you know, at this point, when we look at, let's say, single cell RNA-seq, which I don't particularly like, then we have all these sort of micro sets of things that represent different populations, and then all of a sudden we have an arbitrary number of cell fates.
Yeah, but then you would need to check when you change, because, I mean, the cell would have an input, and then you have the output, which is the RNA-seq, right? Yeah. So then you would need to see how inputs change your RNA-seq data. And yeah, and then you will see if you have clear clusters, which are difficult to obtain, you would see how these clusters, maybe one disappears when you are putting a certain signal, and then you would, yeah, the goal would be to represent each of those clusters as attractors, and
exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a goal.
But in principle, it's the same process.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But RNA-seq data, it's quite difficult to clean. And yeah.
So. I think it's worth pointing out that you've got this complicated model where you glue things together because you don't really want to sort of deal with polynomials. But actually, there's a single polynomial. Pair of polynomials. There's a single polynomial which describes our system, which has just two parameters, and that's kind of, because of Tom's theorem, that's equivalent to the one that you wrote down using all this gluing together and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's really only two state variables, and three parameters, right? Mm-hmm. And now you want the claim, you need to find a map between the biological parameters and the parameters in your model.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had quantitative data, which you don't really have here, you've just got these proportions,
yeah.
Then in principle you could get your fitting of a real relationship between the kind of morphogens or the signals and the parameters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so it just so happens you don't have the right sort of data, but you can still do something interesting.
Yeah, so that's actually my second project. So I don't have RNA-seq data, but I have fluorescence, immunofluorescence data. And so I can get clouds of cells and measure clusters and as a function of what the signals are. So Arye introduced, I don't know why this is not moving. So my laptop decided to get stuck and not work. I'm going to restart. But in the talk he mentioned that he sees in new colonies of human stem cells, when they're in the pluripotent state, which is epiblast, they express OX2. And if you induce them with BMP signaling, they become this trophectoderm-like state, which expresses CDX2. And if you do it in small enough colonies, they do this type of switch behavior from SOX2 to CDX2, depending on the concentration. But if you grow them in standard culture, you get brachyury expression, mesoderm expression, when you put middle concentrations or BMP. So it's showing that you need a secondary signal in order to induce that brachyury expression. So again, we have three fades there. One of them is induced by BMP, which can be like EGF signal. And you have brachyury expression, which is result of a secondary signal that is activated by BMP. So it can be like notch. We don't have this inhibition, but so it's a quite similar system. So we want to use this immunofluorescence data and the fact that we can measure the signal in time, which is a data that I didn't have before, to improve this modeling technique. So I wanted just to show cool images for the first. if my... yeah, so you have data about the correlations between the genes. You can do a lot of, you can play with how the time of exposure of cells to the signal, so you can see whether tilting your landscape or making a signal too big is the same as making a small tilt of the landscape, which is putting a low concentration of the signal, is the same as tilting the landscape for a short time. So whether time of exposure and concentration are interchangeable, and that will also tell you how the landscape changes and things like that, which you can't do in the worm, for example. Can you see something?
Yeah.
There. Okay. So here I'm playing with time of exposure to BMP signaling. So if I don't put BMP, or I put it for 4 hours and I take it out and I wait for another 44 hours and then I fix cells. So I'm putting BMP in a range and then I'm waiting until 48 hours. So all these images are fixed at 48 hours, and the only difference is the time that they receive BMP. So it's a clear range at which you are not, they don't receive enough BMP to kick brachyury expression. But once you pass that time, they have received too much BMP that they have moved into another attractor, CDX2. And I have tried to see, this is, I think that
it's too heavy. Does that have shared markers, like the panel, central bottom panel there? What would that represent in the landscape?
This?
Yeah, not the one like the one that has that
several
one.
Color?
Yeah.
Is that some cells were able to jump
okay.
to a different fate, and some others couldn't. So you will have a mix of two cell fates there. Yeah,
but that's unstable in your landscape.
What is unstable?
That sort of mixed fate, or when you're at the boundary, you're going to one or the other.
No, it's not unstable.
You're saying a given cell has one of the two fates, but not all the cells in the population have the same fate?
Yes. Yes. But so imagine that you have a landscape that has two attractors, right? And you start in one, that is your default state, and you have noise. You don't have only one cell, but you have a population of cells that have noise. And you tilt the landscape like this, or you make this one bigger for a short time. Some of them, which are quicker or have a noise that push them to that phase, would jump. But if you remove it in fast enough, some of the other cells wouldn't have enough time to jump. And so you will have, two populations.
It's not jumping, is it? I mean, you're...
Well, yeah.
You're destroying the landscape.
Yeah, exactly.
By putting the BMP on. The cells all start to move, and then it's a question of when you put the landscape back again, when you... Then they land in an attractor, and that color is their color.
Yeah, I have... I have a picture to show that.
Waddington proposed the landscape to be static, or was it supposed to be kind of moving around? I have an image of it being very static. That's why I think
No, you should think of it as changing as you change.
So but my point was that when you look at these sort of intermediate states don't last very long. They quickly move into one or the other. That's what I'm
But if the cell is not in a middle state, if the population is split.
Right.
So you will have some cells in SOX2 and some other cells in CDX2. But they are not in a transition state. They have already chosen their fate, but some of them have chosen one and some of them have chosen. Yeah, of course, this transition state is not stable. And a cell that has both, well, although you have NMPs that have SOX2 and brachyury, but in this case, you won't see for a long time cells that co-express the two markers if you wait for long enough. So, yeah, exactly. Co-expressing would be they are in a saddle point.
Okay, and that was my question.
Yeah, exactly. So co-expressing is a saddle point,
okay.
And eventually they will fall, yeah.
But in principle, then, that you get dynamical slowing. So near the bifurcation point, actually you can stay in that transition state for a long time, but noise will tend to destroy that.
Yeah, you can play and make
the landscape
it
is flat.
Flat, yeah.
Would that be upper genital?
No.
I mean, me and you are.
Yeah, so if you have a population here instead of one, and you put BMP on, which makes the CDX2 base in 2 low, then the population will start moving there, but if you remove it fast enough, you would end up with the 2. So I wanted to finish by showing these. So I've measured BMP and wind signaling, and it's interesting because the cell seems to be reading a combinatorial, how much BMP signal they are receiving with respect to wind. So if they receive low BMP and low wind, they won't move from the SOX to attractor. So this is the green. You put BMP for a short time, and nogging is a BMP inhibitor. So the green and the blue will have low exposure time to BMP. You see that you have not kicked in wind, and they remain SOX2 positive. If you put BMP for 16 hours, which is this point in which they start expressing wind, if you so this is the purple curve and the orange curve. In the purple curve, I've put nogging, so I have totally inhibited BMP. You see that the cell started to produce wind, but because I removed BMP totally, the wind went down and they remained SOX2 positive. But if I didn't put nogging and there is a bit of BMP in the media still because I couldn't clean it up completely, they had enough BMP to kick wind on, but the BMP was too low. So then you get this brachyury expression. And if you maintain BMP for 48 hours, you have kicked in wind, but the BMP seems to override this wind signaling, and you become CDX2 phase. So I want to put that in a model and make this landscape model now. If you want to ask anything, feel free. Yeah.
In the end, experimental data, experimental wiring diagrams are very speculative and sketchy, I guess, but in any case, is there much correlation between your generated circuit compared to what was proposed earlier for experimental?
Do you mean the wool valve
case
or?
The other one you showed before.
So in order to obtain the model, I didn't have to put that EGF joints and receptor phosphorylates.
Was there any, I don't understand properly.
So
with this model here, so once you fit parameters, what to what purpose? What are you going to do?
So, for example, I can ask, is there any concentration of BMP that gives me as much brachyury as pulsing BMP? Or what is the pulsing time that is the
so the data sets at the moment, you're using a fixed concentration of BMP.
Yeah, I have done a titration, but with a very big range, and I haven't found a concentration of BMP that gives me as much brachyury. So I don't know if, yeah, that will save me having to try many concentrations, for example. I can predict, if I get a model that works, I could predict that. Or I can try and change wind and see, and try and predict the outcomes of changing wind. And
so would the analog for the Volvo situation be that you would ask what the relative, if not, you know, no, absolutely, really, but some, what are the parameter spaces of the activities of notch and EGF signaling that you would need to enable you to obtain X array of cell fates that might be different from the wild type?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what might be useful to you, if you haven't already looked at it, is the data on bubble cell induction in other nematodes that aren't centripetized elegans.
Okay.
Different nematodes have different numbers of cells in their equivalence groups. The symmetry of the equivalence groups is not always the same. The lineage origin of the cells is not the same. The source of the signals is not the same. And the contribution ultimately to the bulb is not the same. And the position of the bulb is not even the same.
Okay.
The genetic basis for all of it is not known in as much detail as C. elegans, but all of the lineage data, the equivalence data, are there. Mm-hmm. And so your model, or this approach, you might be in a position to say, if we just be conservative and let's say get the same two signals,
mm-hmm.
you might have specific things to predict about the relative involvement of these signals such that this pattern of fates is produced rather than this one, and that would provide a testable hypothesis for the evolution of the gene regulatory network across nematodes.
Mm-hmm.
That might be interesting.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. Yeah, you can see which parameters can be kept the same and mm-hmm. which ones you have to change in order to adapt
mm-hmm.
or obtain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. I will, yeah.
Yeah, I can
I'll ask you later. Yeah, okay, thank you.
So this comes back to David's point about the mapping between the model parameters and the biological parameters in terms of trying to make so predictions which aren't sort of trivial, just interpolations of the data you collected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's difficult to know whether you will see something non-trivial from.
Mm. Yeah, so he predicts epistasis, for example, with his model. Yeah.
And how much of that is just a consequence of the topology of the landscape, so you can sort of already know that? You don't actually need to fit it that closely to data.
I think it's a mix, because you have cells that interact with each other. So, both the landscape and also the dynamics and how one cell, how fast one cell, for example, induces a neighboring cell. And
so I suppose you really need a big discussion about the fact that in all the experiments you've described here and in Eric's work, it's clear that timing plays a key role. And the landscape doesn't really have the timing in it. I know you put it in it by fiddling with the landscape, but mm-hmm. in some sense, the landscape doesn't have the timing
mm-hmm.
in a quantitative way, right? Unless you add some sort of metric, Riemannian metric into it.
Mm-hmm. Inside the landscape, it's not. You can put a time constant to modify how quickly your ball moves into the attractor. But yeah.
Yeah, but that requires you to put a Riemannian metric on your landscape, right? Describing what distances look like locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you need a bit more information there. And then the big difference between, the other thing is that the big difference between your model and Eric's is that Eric starts from the idea that the state's symmetric, that the three threat states are symmetric, whereas you start with them being asymmetric.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that difference?
How do you see that they?
What's your comment on that? Because that's presumably quite a big difference between yours and his.
Yeah.
Well, and with Roswell.
We decided that it should be asymmetric, because we didn't see we didn't see that this phase would come back to the third phase, right? So we needed a phase that was special kind of in the landscape. While for them, I think all of the three are interchangeable. And we thought that the third fade is the default fade, and once you pass that boundary, you cannot go back to that one.
Right.
Yeah.
So what about the experiment where you get a third, third, third?
So there are some that haven't passed that boundary. Some of them have passed the boundary and are in between the two states, so you would be in that first saddle here. You would be around here. So if you remove the signal soon enough, you have moved your ball here, and you would have a third up there. I think that can explain. Good? Okay, thanks for coming.